Show me the best ways to have the most fun, inspiring the largest number of people to easily, naturally, joyously experience vibrantly, exquisitely, healthy, wealthy, passionate living in the shortest amount of time with the least intrusion into their lives so we can all get our needs met and celebrate a global loving community that works for everyone. Yes, that's the goal. That's the intention. That's the prayer. And so love when you tune in because each week something is going to be offered in support of that. And before we get started, I want to take a moment to thank our sponsor, AdvancedLivingComfort.com, home of the comfort technology. It's a Clark Kent clock with superpowers. And what does that mean? It's a tiny digital clock with the microcircuitry modified, so when you plug it in, it creates a coherent, harmonized field, kind of like having the Dalai Lama show up and meditate in your room. It's a beautiful energy that counteracts electro pollution from all the wires and cell phone and Wi-Fi and the smart meters. They call them smart meters because it's smart that they don't have to come into your house while you get fried from that stuff. Not very smart for us, huh? So anyway, check out AdvancedLivingComfort.com. You'll find something easy that's well worth your while. And I'm going to talk about another going from one thing that's easy and well worth your while. What if meditation was so much easier to do? We've heard the term meditation. We think, oh, my gosh, it took this guy, 10 years, 20 years, they've been doing this stuff. I'm a little busy right now. Well, our special guest today is going to share some wonderful things from her book, Meditation, The Complete Guide. And this person happens to be, just in case you're wondering, who is it? It's Patricia Monahan. And she earned her undergraduate and first graduate degree at the University of Minnesota, where she studied English and French literature. And she's just so fascinated, maintains this ongoing interest in French literature, especially in the symbolist poets. And, of course, that might not mean poets that play the cymbals. And then after graduate school, she worked as a journalist in both Minnesota and Alaska. Yes, and she's going to probably be going to the North and South Pole soon. I mean, give her credit for being a hardy gal. And she's writing about culture, nature, and the intersection of the two, which is kind of exciting to contemplate. And she also earned an MFA, a Master of Fine Arts, in creative writing of poetry from the University of Alaska. And then academically, in the late 80s, she moved to Chicago to pursue her higher education and earned her PhD in interdisciplinary studies of science and literature from the Union Institute in Cincinnati, and that was in 94 that she got that completed. In 95, she joined the faculty for the School of New Learning at the DePaul University where she teaches classes in arts and environmental sciences. And yes, with her fascination of poets, could you imagine she's actually written some poetry? Well, how about four books in which she shares an emphasis on each book as more than just a random collection of poems. So Patricia has this sneaky side to her in which she's not just throwing stuff in a book. She actually has some beautiful intentions about what she puts in and the sequencing of it all. Oh, boy. Well, so much there. Hopefully we can maybe even hear a little bit of a poem from her. And then throughout her career, Patricia's work has dealt with issues of spirituality, especially women's spirituality. And in 1979, she published the first Encyclopedia of Feminine Divinities, a book which has remained steadily in print since then and was recently republished in a two-volume set as the Encyclopedia of Goddesses and Heroines. How's that for fun, folks? Guys, look that up. You'll make friends with more women when you know this stuff. And she has also published an Encyclopedia of Celtic Myth and the Encyclopedia of Celtic Myth and Folklore, and has edited a three-volume collection of essays entitled Goddesses in World Culture. It was published in late 2010. And she, she just sits around and writes. No. She's a practitioner of Qigong, Zazen, and several other forms of meditation. And she collaborated with a yoga teacher, Eleanor Varick, to write the Encyclopedic Meditation, The Complete Guide, which we'll be discussing today, which was published in 1999. And a revised and expanded edition is coming out now that I have in my hand. See? Look it, I'm holding it. Oh, darn, it's radio. Anyway, including several new sections, and it's got expanded resource lists. And she's a longtime member of the Society of Friends, which are Quakers, and is also a companion on the Fourth Order of St. Francis and Claire, an interfaith religious organization, and teaches workshops on women's spirituality through the Women's Theological Institute and the Temple of Diana. And just because she has so much extra spare time after doing all that, she's an avid gardener with a large organic garden that we're all invited to her place. I didn't mention this to her, so we won't. And it's got an orchard.
Thanks for the
warning. Yeah, you're welcome. And a vineyard. And that she works with her husband, Dr. Michael McDermott. And yes, in their spare time after their teaching, and he also in his clinic work at the Cook County Hospital, they also do what is called locovore, which is a form of diet in which you eat locally and seasonally things that are around you, so you're not getting stuff from all over the planet. It's kind of interesting. So, folks, let's welcome her and just dive on into this. Hello, Patricia.
You've made me intimidated by myself by going through all that.
Yes, exactly.
I'm not sure I can live up to my introduction here.
Now we have to take about a meditation break while Patricia kind of centers herself, realizing that, yes, she's really done a lot. And, of course, folks, one of the things that I so admire is when you think, how do people do so much? And here she is, very accomplished in so many areas. And guess what her book's about? Meditation. Now, could there be some link between someone that does meditation and their ability to have a more complex and yet fulfilled and orderly organized life? What do you say about that, Patricia?
I don't think anybody's ever asked me that, but I think you're onto something there. I think one misapprehension about meditation is that it's, quote, navel-gazing. You know, all you're doing is thinking about yourself and staring at your navel. That's assuming you can see your navel.
We have special devices for that.
Yeah, but taking it from a Quaker perspective, and I've been a member of the Society of Friends for 40 years, the idea in Quaker worship is to sit in the silence and then find within the connection with some calling that you should then go outward and fulfill in the outer world. So far from being something that removes you and makes you less engaged with life, meditation can actually strengthen you to be active in your outer world, if you can juxtapose the outer world in which people are active in the inner world. So I think actually that being a pretty fervent meditator does help me keep centered in all the things that I do. I think one of the reasons that I'm productive is that a long time ago I learned that for every no you say, you're opening the door to a later yes. A lot of times we get just overwhelmed with all the busyness of life, and we don't say no to enough things. My publisher, who I adore, New World Library, they have a well-known book out called The Power of Now, and I've joked with them that I'm going to write The Power of No. Saying no to a lot of stuff allows you to have space to say a really fervent yes to other things. A good example is just coming over here today to get ready for our interview. I went by a mall, and there were, I think, 1,000 cars, running around, and people were honking. And I thought, oh, yeah, I could be engaged in compulsive consumption at this time of year, but I choose not to. We have a family commitment to not engaging in excessive consumption, and what we do every year is we plant part of our garden as a Christmas gift, and we create something that we're going to give to everybody from the garden. So I dare not reveal what this year's garden gifts will be, but for example, one year we grew extra tomatoes and onions and garlic, and we gave people spaghetti dinner packages where we gave them homemade tomato sauce and onions and garlic and some Wisconsin cheese and some spaghetti so they could make their meal. Oh, that's right. There were some dried peppers in there, too. So every year we kind of plan to have some part of the garden that's connected with our Christmas presents. So we don't have to run around at this time of year crazily wondering what we're going to get for so-and-so, because we've, already had the pleasure of growing food for our friends and family that we're going to surprise them with. Another year we grew dried beans and sent everybody bean pots that we had acquired over the year at thrift stores and garage sales, along with local maple syrup and the makings of baked beans. So we have a lot of fun planning our Christmas garden. There have been times when our plans did not come about and we had to punt. gardening is a humbling experience. My husband is an ER doc, and he likes to say that hauling people back from the jaws of death is easy compared to gardening.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
It's humbling to be out there with nature and the weather and trying to, hope the crops come in. I have great admiration for farmers and those who provide our food for us.
Yes.
But I'm getting away from meditation. So meditation, one reason I think people think they can't meditate or are become meditation dropouts, is, as you talked about in the introduction, is that they're probably trying to do too much. We're coming on, the first of the year, and people will make their New Year's resolutions. And if you make a resolution to sit in utter silence for an hour a day, 5 days a week, I can almost give you a written guarantee that by February 1st, you'll be saying, I can't meditate. That didn't work for me.
Oh.
Because that is a very strenuous form of meditation. Although you seem to be sitting still, it's quite strenuous on the inner level. So I always hold that anyone has 15 minutes a day and nobody has an hour a day at the start. You may work up to having, wanting to commit more time, but if you start with such an extreme idea of what you're going to do, you'll be a dropout in no time. And the other thing that people do is they choose a form of meditation that is just inappropriate to them. Maybe they are very visually oriented, and they choose a form of meditation that is, you know, puts them in a situation where they're constantly visually stimulated. My yoga teacher always says that we should practice with our eyes open, and I'm always getting busted for having my eyes closed because I'm very distracted by visual phenomena. So when I'm trying to, you know, be in the yogic moment and I have my eyes open, there's some part of me that's going, oh, look, over there.
Yeah.
So I'm constantly closing my eyes. Open your eyes. You know, keep a soft gaze. But for me, the less visual noise there is, the easier. I can take sounds more easily than I can distractions. So I have a place I meditate where I have a little altar set up, and it's very calming. And yes, ideally, I could meditate in any time or any place. But if you set yourself up at the beginning to be so overstimulated, then you're not going to be able to get into that habit sufficiently to really be able to meditate successfully. Another thing that makes people drop out is that they, or makes people hesitate at the start, is that they think meditation is a religion, and they'll say, well, I can't meditate because I'm Catholic, and, you know, yoga comes from the Hindu religion, and I'll probably start worshiping Shiva and Kali.
Oh, no.
No. Lots of people practice yoga without even knowing who Shiva and Kali are. But besides that, even within any tradition, there are meditative forms that you can embrace. So if you do have that concern that meditation is a religious path and you are in a different religious path, we found there is literally no religious path that doesn't have some form of meditation.
Ah, well, this is pretty exciting. I mean, we live in our country primarily a Christian Judeo culture. And I notice part 6 of this wonderful book, Meditation, the Complete Guide, talks about Christianity. And
one of the reasons that we put in that chapter is that when we were first doing the book, and I want to give lots of credit to my co-author, Eleanor Virich. She goes by Terry. Terry is now in her early 80s. She's still a yoga practitioner and teacher. She's an amazing woman. She also has a PhD in biochemistry and brings just a wealth of wisdom to the table. She brought a lot to this book. When we first started talking about it, we had actually envisioned a book that was more what you'd call conventional meditation, you know, Buddhism, yoga, and so forth. As part of our research, we went out to bookstores. And I highly recommend, if you're thinking of writing a book, to do this because it will help you figure out how to write your book. So we go out to bookstores and we would ask, we would try to find a bookstore where the clerk hadn't been on duty for just a day. We'd ask, I'm looking for, and then we describe the book we plan to write. I'm looking for a book that tells me about all the different kinds of meditations. And then we'd see where they'd lead us in the bookstore, and then we'd look at the competition. Well, I went to one bookstore in a very Christian community, and the clerk said, kind of leaned over and said, in a low voice, you don't want to do that. That's the work of the devil. And I was surprised at this because it had never crossed my mind. So we started looking into that and found that there are a number of Christian denominations that warn people against meditation. And that's really unfortunate because meditation is actually very effective from, you know, if you take a non-spiritual, just a medical point of view, there's lots of evidence that it helps lower blood pressure, deal with chronic pain, insomnia. These are reasons that people might want to meditate. On the emotional level, there are lots of studies now about the impact of using meditation as a treatment, you know, literal treatment for PTSD. And I was just hearing this week about Wisconsin on using meditation for vets who suffer from PTSD, and very effective. So if someone is told they can't meditate for religious reasons and they really need it for medical or emotional reasons, that's tragic. That's really sad.
Yeah.
So this led us to look into, well, what are some Christian forms of meditations? And they're there, you know.
Okay.
One of them actually is in the chapter on mixed and mixed forms that are found in a number of traditions. And one is the what Catholics call the rosary, the prayer beads. Prayer beads are found in lots and lots of traditions. And there are even recently pagan prayer beads. Basically, a prayer bead is just a string of beads, sometimes literally a string, sometimes they're made into a circuit, so you go round and round, and you repeat a certain set of words on each bead. Sometimes you might repeat different prayers or series of words on different sizes of beads or something like that.
Yeah.
But like many meditations, it's a repetition, which... is one of the primary ways that we keep the mind occupied in order to soothe it. Oddly enough, if you keep repeating things, it'll have a soothing impact on you. So prayer beads, you know, you can say, well, I say the rosary, that's my form of meditation. Contemplative reading is used by many Christian denominations, reading the Bible. Read it and then reflect on it. One form of Christian-based meditation that I think is marvelous is the Taizé singing, which was founded, about 60 years ago, by Switzerland Eastern France, by a man who, Frere Roger, who was concerned at Protestants and Catholics not being able to discourse across doctrinaire lines. And the singing is just repeating these beautiful harmonies and melodies, sometimes for an hour, 2 hours, sometimes all day at the retreats. It's incredibly moving and very soothing at the same time. So those are all within the Christian tradition. You need not become a Buddhist in order to meditate. And then there are people who are secular. They are not really interested in the spiritual aspects of meditation. They're interested in what we call the medical aspects, as I just defined, or the performance aspects. They want to become more creative. They want to become more productive. And there are lots of studies that show that retreating to a meditative space does allow you to come back, you know, recharge, as it were. Ultimately, I think that a long-term meditation practice will lead you in a spiritual direction. So even if you enter for what you might define as secular reasons, I think you're drawn into spiritual in the largest sense, being aware of something beyond your ego, you know, something that is bigger than humanity. And you might call that, you know, the land. It might be the divine, the ancestors, you know, the god, the goddess, the divinities. There are lots of ways of defining that beyond the human, the transhuman reality. And I think if you meditate, eventually you'll begin to experience that.
Wow, this is kind of interesting.
Even if you don't start that way.
Yeah, because I was just trying to tie some loose ends together, and one part of it was in Genesis, where God took 6 days creating heavens and earth, and then rested on the seventh day, and so giving us our Sabbath, and which is supposed to be this really time of rest or celebration. And then there's somewhere, I don't have the reference right in front of me, in the Bible about to pray ceaselessly.
Ceaselessly, certainly.
Just to keep a prayer going and of different sort, whether it's Jesus is my Lord, or someone was pointing out to me that Abraham seems to be the common place from which Islam, Judaism, and Catholicism all came.
Yes, they're called the Abrahamic religions. And
yes. It's kind of fascinating. But so what I'm liking, and I'd like you to help share a little bit more about, is in forms of meditation, is that there can be things that we're doing in the midst of our day that actually fit in with what might be called this, praying ceaselessly or calling forth the spiritual moments in the midst of our day.
Absolutely. One good way to begin a meditative practice is to look at what you already do. Instead of thinking, I can't learn to meditate until I take a week off and go to California, probably California. I can't just learn to meditate. And it is true that some forms of meditation do require instruction, but there are lots of forms of meditation that don't. And you may be doing things in your daily life that have a connection with a tradition of meditation or can be developed into a form of meditation. When we first did the book, I'm a very fervent needle worker. I always have practice going. And I argued for needlework, craft work, as being a form of meditation. And I had to convince my co-author of that because she was not entirely convinced at first. And this was a very far out chapter, 13 years ago when the book first came out.
Yeah.
There were very few other resources that suggested that the repetitive motion of craft working can be meditative. And now there's a whole bunch of knitting sutras and the Zen of Knitting and things like that. So this has become a lot more prominent. But that might be something that people are already doing,
Yeah.
And now, could I make that meditative? And in defining meditation, we took the stance that meditation is not a religion, it's a practice. And this is a kind of interesting thing to talk about because it's not a theory and it's not a belief. It's something you do. So you could, believe in Tai Chi but never actually do Tai Chi, in which case you're not actually meditating, you're just thinking about it. And so you want to think of meditation as a practice, and generally it is a practice that you do with some regularity and over some length of time. All too often in America today, we do look for the silver bullet. We're looking for immediate gratification. And, I took a week-long meditation class. I didn't get anything out of it. Well, probably not. Now, I don't think that you have to wait 15 years of steadily meditating before you see some results in your level of centeredness, but it's not going to happen in a week, and it probably won't happen in a month. It'll take a bit of time for you to kind of find your practice and then have it become part of your life in a way that you begin to see the impact. It isn't an instant fix, and lots of times we'd like that. We also have to remember that not only is it a practice and something we need to do regularly, it's something that is going to find its way into the rest of our life, but we may not immediately see how it does that. So all of a sudden we realize, a year ago that would have really bothered me what that guy did at the faculty meeting, but I was a lot calmer. So it's not like at the moment you necessarily go, wow, I can see my meditative practice is really working here, but rather you begin to change. But in defining meditation, we said to ourselves, so if it's not a religion, what is it? And yes, there are meditation teachers who will say, meditation is such and such. And by the way, I teach that. I've rarely heard somebody say, meditation is such and such, and you got to go down the block for that. The thing that they're teaching is the thing that they'll define meditation as. This is it, and this is it only. And we said, if you take, what are people looking for who say, I want to learn to meditate? They're looking for some sense of centeredness, some sense of, you might call it detachment, by which I don't mean being unemotional, not having any feelings, but rather not being swept away by every emotion that comes along. I want some kind of sense of ability to withdraw, catch a breath, be more centered as I respond. Well, what is, if that's what people want, is centeredness, what gets them there? And we found that there were, in addition to the religious traditions or spiritual traditions, there were a number of creative things that people can do. Gardening, for example. Many people find that an hour of weeding is the most peaceful part of their day. We had some interesting discussions. For example, would massage be a meditation? Well, you know, if you're looking for relaxation, massage can certainly help. But we decided a couple things. First of all, it was important not to have to pay somebody to do it. So, you know, you had to be able to do it yourself, more or less. It's hard to give yourself a massage. I mean, it's technically possible for some parts of your body to be able to massage yourself. But body work, although it has many relaxation aspects, it's not meditation. And yet, many forms of exercise can become meditation. So we also define meditation in terms of not being oriented toward a specific product. To go back to knitting, it is certainly possible to have a deadline to get the scarf done for somebody's birthday, and you're knitting late at night frantically, and your stitches are getting tighter, and you're not feeling the slightest bit centered and relaxed. I would not call that a meditative form of craft work. That's just trying to get the product done. So meditation is not only being in the moment, but not having a strain toward a specific product. If you are meditating in order to lower your blood pressure, and you're sitting there going, down, down, goddamn you, down, you know, that would not be meditating. It's very paradoxical because if you're meditating, your blood pressure may in fact go down. But if you're meditating to make your blood pressure go down, you're not meditating. So you get this kind of interesting paradigm.
So, my God,
so
this sounds like a bit of...
life, in terms of your daily life,
yeah.
One ideal is that you can be kind of meditating as you go through, you know, anything. There's a great Zen saying, you know, before illumination I chopped wood and carried water. After illumination, what did I do? Chop wood, carry water. The externals could be exactly the same, but the attitude in which you're doing it is different.
Yeah, that's interesting, that perspective that I think is so important. And in this, to me, this meditative thing that you're talking about, there could be a quiet time, or it can be done in the midst of our daily lives. And what's kind of, I don't know if we find it interesting or humorous, is if we look back to the creation of the world in Genesis, and what's written there, there is no reference to God creating the different things on the different days, and then stopping at the end of the day and going, whew, that was awful. How was your day, dear? I had a bad day creating this part of planet Earth. You know?
I think I'll watch a little TV now.
Yeah. I need a break. So,
and I don't want to by any means seem to be slighting the great traditions of meditation. My late husband was a very serious student of Zen, and we sat Zazen for many years. I never studied with a master myself, but he was close to a master. And I have great respect for the tradition of sitting and clearing the mind and that whole Buddhist way of being in a centered space. I have great respect for it. I also practice Qigong, which comes from the Taoist tradition from China, which is very much related to Chinese medicine in terms of the balance of, you know, the positive and the negative energies. And in Qigong, Tai Chi is a form of Qigong, you're doing a lot of connecting your inner space with the cosmos, you know, imagining a great line going from above down through you and into the earth. So there's a lot of visioning that goes on while you're doing the motions. I do contemplative reading every day. I do, which is different than just reading. If I'm reading a novel, I want to know what's next. And contemplative reading is staying with the page for a while and being with it and reflecting on it. And it's a much slower, more I can't imagine reading a novel or a fast-paced story in a meditative way. You really want small nuggets. Poetry is perfect, where you read it slowly, you reflect on it. You might read it a couple of times. Many people read the Bible in that sort of meditative fashion. So I pull my meditations from a number of different traditions, including creative traditions. We have a chapter on journaling, and for those who are interested in improving their connection with their deeper self, journaling is really powerful. Again, you can't be product-oriented. You can't be writing a journal hoping you'll get a journal you can publish, because that would kind of get in the way of actually journaling, which has to be something where you're just letting the inner voice speak to you and then seeing what you say. Some people call that free writing, just writing freely and not editing. Getting the editor out of the way is important if you're journaling as a meditation. You're not going back and correcting it and trying to make the perfect sentence, but really letting it flow freely. And often you'll find yourself going, wow, I didn't know I was thinking about that. Wow, yeah. I didn't know that's the way I felt. You're really kind of, I sometimes joke, it's really cheap therapy, you know. You're finding out a lot about yourself. And there are some forms of journal meditation that have to do with limiting what you write about. So, for example, in the Methodist tradition, the early Methodists had a method. That's where their name comes from. And part of their method was every night they would write in their journal, reflecting on the day and asking, how did I stand in terms of my quest for being a good person? They're also that also is used by early Quakers as well. So this is a kind of journaling where you're specifically using your journal to reflect on your improvement as a person seeking to be a holier person, or a more, you know, you could say, I'm seeking a more centered person. So you might say, as I look back over today, I see I lost it at about noon. so how am I doing with my inner struggle?
So that's kind of like the writing from the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde perspective.
How so? Tell me.
Well, I was just fine. I was Jekyll. You know, being that good source of love and healing. And then was it after lunch? Was it my digestion?
Oh, right,
what the heck happened?
And he was the other person entirely.
Yeah.
I hope it wouldn't be that extreme. And, you know, that reminds me of a question someone asked me a couple of days ago. Can meditation ever be dangerous? And I really had to think about that because, you know, one could imagine circumstances where someone could engage in a meditative practice that somehow caused a psychotic break or something. But we actually did some research on whether or not there were reasons you shouldn't use different forms.
Yeah.
Other than finding that certain kinds of trance-like conditions can be bad for people who have unmedicated epilepsy, we didn't find any medical reason that people would find any kind of meditation to be dangerous. And there have been no studies that we're able to find that suggested that there could be any damage psychologically, you know, that in a way this is a natural healing space that we have. This work that I was mentioning earlier that I've been reading up on about the work with people with PTSD, far from being possibly disruptive, it gives the space to go into when things feel out of control. And the kind of meditation they're teaching is, you know, a very primary form, which is counting of breath. And it's interesting how like repetition, breath is one of those things that unites a lot of different forms of meditation. Just paying attention to your breath, sometimes by literally counting the breath, sometimes by just attending, you know, pay attention to that breath. There's a wonderful Islamic meditation from the Sufi tradition, the four breaths, the breath of air, the breath of fire, breath of water, and breath of earth. And when you think about your breathing apparatus, you can breathe in through your nose, you can breathe in through your mouth, right?
Yeah.
So the Sufi breaths, you are breathing in through the nose, out through the nose, in through the nose, out through the mouth, in through the mouth, out through the nose, in through the mouth, and out through the mouth. Those are the four breaths. And you do these in cycles of five. It's very interesting how powerful those simple breathing exercises are. I was interested to find out, for example, that what the Sufi tradition calls the water breath, which is breathing in through the nose and then back out kind of in a sigh through the mouth, is used similarly, almost identically, the same kind of breathing is used in Lamaze training as a way of releasing tension. So the water breath, which in the Sufi tradition is releasing, is in fact biologically apparently releasing. So the breath is a very powerful meditative practice, and it also has biological, biochemical results on our bodies. Meditation is not just something happening in our minds. It's happening in our mind bodies. We are both a mind and a body. We can't separate our mind out and say it's in one part of our body. Our mind and our body are together. The breath really is a very powerful connection for us. When we're focusing on our breathing, which so many meditative traditions ask us to do, we become aware of, where our breath is going. In my yoga class, for example, we do lots of these different kinds of breaths where we breathe into our belly and then breathe into our midriff and we breathe into our chest, feel the different where the breath goes, learning to control the breath and be able to breathe deeply. Lots of people in America breathe very shallowly. It's called emergency breathing. If you put your hand on your upper chest, by your neck, by your collarbone, and feel your breath.
Okay.
If you are not breathing deeply, if you're in a panic situation, you'll just breathe right down to your throat. It's very shallow breathing. And you get sort of starved for oxygen. So one of the things that meditation is doing is helping us open up so we're oxygenating our bodies more. So one of the reasons you feel better is that you have actually gotten oxygen flowing through your system. Of course, oxygen is absolutely vital for, our cellular health. So if you're constantly sort of shallow breathing and you've gotten in that habit, then you're not getting as much oxygen as you could with deeper breathing. So in addition to those spiritual impacts that we've been talking about, meditation has real biological effects as well, particularly the ones that involve focusing on your breathing, filling your whole breathing cavity with air so that you're really opening up. Yoga postures are often really good for that because, if you've got your arms out, you're not all crunched up. most of my day, like so many people's days, is spent, hunched over the computer, and boy, you're not exactly opening your chest when you're all hunched over the computer.
Oh, wow. So I'm guessing that's a moment of a reminder about ergonomics. To actually create a desk space in which you can be on the computer and at the same time be having nice posture and be able to do that. And what I'm understanding, is this accurate? When you meditate, the body will go into a better breathing pattern automatically?
Yes and no. If some forms of meditation, for example, if I'm knitting, I'm not particularly paying attention to my breathing. Although I was reading some folklore about ancient, well, not ancient, but, you know, a couple hundred years ago, knitting traditions where people would be knitting by the fire. And this folklorist said, well, how could they count their stitches? Because it'd be dark. And found out that a lot of folk songs actually have kind of counting rhymes and so forth, and people would sing these together while knitting, and they were actually counting their stitches. And there was this singing and breathing together while knitting. So, wow, that was really interesting. I never. So if I were singing and knitting, I might be getting, you know, more breath going.
Yeah.
But many of the traditions, the moving traditions, like Qigong and Tai Chi, yoga, certainly sitting with them, they're asking you specifically to pay attention to your breath. When you do Qigong, say as you're pushing out, imagine you know, holding your hands in front of you and pushing out like you're pushing somebody away. As you're doing that, you're breathing out. And then when I pull my hands back, then I breathe in. So the postures themselves ask for specific breath. Similarly, when doing yoga, you'll often be, you know, as you're reaching up, you're breathing in, and as you're, you know, going down to the floor, you're letting the breath out. And within the postures themselves are included instructions for how to breathe. And frankly, if you're exerting yourself somewhat, you will tend to breathe more deeply. So, you know, those kind of go along. Sitting meditations often involve some focus on the breath. You know, as I say, sometimes people suggest simply counting them, sometimes just being aware. As you are aware, you tend to almost automatically relax and breathe more deeply. But deep breathing is a really powerful form of meditation if done with consciousness, just paying attention. That's a lot of meditation, paying attention.
Mm. Okay, yeah. And attention to right there, right now, in the moment with
right.
yourself. And,
right.
Okay, versus contemplating, like, you're in Minnesota, so how the Vikings doing in the season? And
my greatest struggle as a meditator is that my default button on my brain is list-making. You know, so I sit down, I immediately think, oh, I should do this, I should do that. Mental list.
Yeah.
And one of the great messages, spiritual messages of meditation to me is that, you know, it's not tomorrow, and it's not yesterday, it's now. And the breath helps us on that. I mean, the breath is right now. The breath you're taking right now is the only breath that counts. I can't breathe my breath for Monday. I can't do that.
Oh, you can't, like, stock up over the weekend?
Yeah, and I can't, like, redo the breath from yesterday that I did badly.
Oh, no.
You're just in the moment. Breath is
okay.
In the moment. And similarly in meditation, one would hope you'd get to the point of not making the list of what you should be doing tomorrow, but being in the present, and so also not focusing on what, you know, you should have done yesterday. Because yesterday's gone, tomorrow's in here, you're here now.
Yeah, well, I'm curious, Patricia, because I'm thinking to myself, so many religious traditions talk about some form of spiritual connection, the Holy Ghost, the Spirit, Holy Spirit within, something like that, or calling upon God to assist us, that, you know, prayers can be answered, type of a thing. And then I'm thinking, okay, is some of this time of meditation where we are just still and quiet or doing something, how does that tie into actually allowing time for us to set aside the busyness of our lives and all it's doing, and allow some form of communion where the support of spirit can actually be more active in our lives?
Some people who have a rather rigid Buddhist vision would say that prayer is not the same as meditation.
Okay.
Because prayer is directed outward and meditation is done. I'm a little less rigid than that. some people, prayer and meditation, what some people call meditation would be what other people would refer to as prayer and vice versa. The most important thing is not to engage the will. There's a wonderful story about the Baal Shem Tov, one of the great Jewish sages. And if I can remember the story, a woman comes to him and says, "My daughter is dying, my daughter is dying." And he says, "Go home and weave a blanket." So she thinks, "Well, I don't know what that's about, but I, you know, this is what the wife says." So she goes home and weaves a blanket.
Yeah.
And then she brings the blanket. Oh, then she, the daughter recovers. And she goes to the Baal Shem Tov and says, "You were right. I wove the blanket, and my daughter recovered." And the Baal Shem Tov says, "You wove the blanket, and your daughter recovered. But weaving the blanket didn't make your daughter recover. On the other hand, if you hadn't woven the blanket, your daughter would not have recovered." It's a wonderful story because it, and I think I've got some of the details wrong, but that's the general flavor of it. She might have been weaving a shawl or something like that. But anyway, the idea of you're doing these things and you're hoping for an outcome, but you can't make it happen. You know, you can't force the hand of God, as it were. But if you're not doing those things, you can pretty much be sure that whatever you're hoping for won't happen. So I might be praying for a certain outcome, but I can't control the outcome. I can't, you know, make something happen because I really want it to happen. On the other hand, if I'm not praying, that also changes. If I'm not meditating or praying, that also changes things. So somehow the process of meditating does change things, but it's not a direct correlation. It's not will that's doing it. It's not, okay, I'm going to meditate 5 times this week, and then I'm going to get an A on my test because I'm going to be so relaxed. I'm going to go into that test. I'm going to be like totally with it, you know, and I'll get an A. And then you might go in there and, you know, you might not get an A. But on the other hand, you might. And it might actually be that, you know, in that center you are able to, you know, get over your test anxiety. So it's an odd thing. You can't set things in motion where you say, I'm going to get this out of my meditation. It's a wonderful mystery, actually, to go back to gardening. You know, each year we plant with all great hopes that everything will, you know, every garden is perfect in January. See it all. It's going to be perfect. And then, you know, you're out there and, you know, the weather's different, or the, you know, 1 year we planted our garden 3 times because we kept getting flooded out, you know, but we kept trying. And now, at the end of the year, you've got something. It's not exactly what you thought you'd have in all precision in January, but if you hadn't planted the garden, you would have nothing.
Ah, yes. Now, I'm just wondering, because we've got about a minute left to...
I
want to give people your website. I mean, time just goes by so beautifully when we're engaged in learning so much from you. I appreciate it. Would you share the website that people can find your book and more about you and some of the things you offer?
www.patricia-monahan.com, and it's M-O-N-A-G-H-A-N. It's the Irish language spelling.
Ah.
The silent G.
Yeah. Okay, very
it
good.
It looks like Monaghan.
Ah, Monaghan, okay.
Monaghan.
Okay, M-O-N-A-G-H-A-N, patricia-monahan.com.
Correct.
And, yes, I just want to, and is there a quickie thought that you might just share a wrap-up thought for would-be or meditators out there?
Well, everybody has some time every day, 10 or 15 minutes, and take that and use that regularly. Don't feel you have to become an instant meditator and meditate for a long time every day without fail. Find a space for it. You'll never regret it.
Ah, okay. So find a a space, and it could be a minute, it could be 2 minutes, something, begin comfortably is what I'm hearing you say.
Correct.
It's not like a task, it's like a treat.
And one would hope that it's such a treat that you seek it out more and it becomes a regular part of your life.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, ease into it, folks, because it's worth it. And you're worth
and
doing, giving yourself this gift.
Thank you for what you're doing and for bringing all this good stuff to people.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I just love it. And thank you, Patricia, for taking time out of your busy day in the holiday season here to share with us something that will help us get through the holidays and into a 2012 in a much better place.
And wonderful, and happy holidays back to you.
Thank you. And to you, Patricia, and my beloved listeners, until we meet again, God bless, and goodbye for now. Let go.